A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together we're Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast.
Hello, 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 hello. I'm Gary Bain. I'm with the formidable Peter Hart. And I'd just like to say, Pete, today is something special. Today is our 100th podcast.
We must be millionaires.
No. We do now have Buy Me a Coffee, if you'd like to buy us a coffee, if you're enjoying the podcast.
And how are we doing on that?
Well, we've got £1 each for every episode.
Oh, I'm retiring. Oh, I am retired. Yeah. Anyway.
So, to mark our 100th episode, Pete, today we're going to do the Air War, Battle of Arras.
And this is the first of, I think it's about 12 episodes on the Battle of Arras. Now,
that'd be about 12 quid then.
It's well worth the effort. And what are we doing? The thing is, the Bloody April is what everybody knows. The Battle of Arras is Bloody April to the Royal Flying Corps. And as the tale sometimes told, it's a heroic story of our brave untrained lads flying over the lines for no good reason, being met by vicious, murderous bastards like that evil, evil Gary, Baron Manfred von Richthofen, and other Huns. And those bastards shoot down our brave lads, and the evil General Trenchard keeps sending them off.
But he's suffering too, because he's having to sit at his big plush desk and ride around in his Rolls Royce.
That is a terrible fate that he's got. You remember that,
I remembered
you?
That.
Anyway, the thing is that we don't think that's what happened at all. And this series of podcasts is looking at why it was fought, and then we're looking at everything about the battle. And I hope it'll be a really interesting series of podcasts. Air War, Battle of Arras.
So
what's going on? What's that song? How does it go? You're good at singing soul songs. Sing "What's Going On" by Marvin Gaye for me.
What's going on? I'm too young. I've just realised.
Wasn't that on the album "Sexual Healing"?
I definitely wouldn't know. Anyway, getting on. Air battles like the bloody April 1917. They just happen, don't they? They just come along.
It just happened apropos of nothing, you mean?
Yeah.
No. The Royal Flying Corps is... What is it? What's the important word other than royal and flying in that name?
Well, it's a corps. So it's got little or no freedom of action. It's completely dominated as in its duty because it had to fill the requirements of the army.
It
had
part
no choice.
Of it.
It's part of the army.
It's not a separate military.
Well, not
service.
Yet. No.
No. That's an April Fool's Day, 1918. The RAF's formed.
I'm saying nothing.
Yeah. Now, there's also one thing. Don't talk about obsolescent aircraft, but do the men at the front have any power to change the tools of their trade? You think, Gary?
No, they've got to fight and often die in the aircraft that they've been supplied with.
Why? Why? Well,
we've mentioned this before, Pete. New aircraft, they take many months, sometimes years, to reach the battlefront. And, so why, I guess, are the RFC and let's not forget the Royal Naval Air Service, forced into action with inferior or obsolescent aircraft in the spring of 1917? What's the answer, Pete? What's the answer?
Well, the answer lies with the French. French high command. Patouille, we'd normally go, except that we're actually great admirers
of the French.
Although, there is something about to happen to the French command, which isn't quite so good. So who's it, who is the French commander-in-chief at the end of 1916?
Well, the plans for 1917, they're originally conceived by the then French commander-in-chief, who's General Joseph Joffre.
Now, he'd got a pretty good relationship with Haig, hadn't he? I mean, it's not exactly bosom pals, but they've got a working relationship, hadn't they?
Yeah, they had. And Joffre, he envisaged pressing hard on the Western Front during the winter, at least so far as the weather permitted.
The kind of wintery stuff, yeah.
And the reason was to keep up the pressure on the Germans.
And then what were they going to do?
Well, then they'd look to thrust hard in coordinated British and French offensives on either side of the Somme battlefield.
So, the British, they were to attack the German salient enclosed between the Ancre and the Scarpe rivers after first capturing the heights of the Vimy Ridge. That will become the Battle of Arras. The French were to attack first to the south between the Somme and the Oise rivers.
Oise.
And then their major effort would be along the River Aisne. The British proposed to follow this up with something that was close to Haig's heart. What was that?
Well, he wanted a summer offensive in Flanders.
Why?
Well, it's a question of
that's clearly not in the notes.
Objectives.
That's clearly
it's a
not
question of strategic objectives. There were fewer in the Somme area in Haig's mind.
None,
and he felt that, you know, they could make more of a difference to winning the war.
Submarine bases and the Rulers railway junction just behind,
which I was just about to come on to.
I know you were, but I thought if I interrupted you, I could make you look a bit dumb.
Now, Joffre's proposals, they'd all been agreed at the Chantilly Conference.
Chantilly lays, and it lays, and
I'm definitely too young. Big bopper. Of the 15th of November 1916. You're being particularly difficult today, Pete, if you don't mind.
I'm in a good mood.
Oh, we'll soon change that.
So, those proposals are agreed. Now, the Germans, I presume they just laid back and thought of England.
Well, they probably did think of England, but of course not. You've got another party there, haven't you? You've got the Germans. What are they going to do? Well, they took radical action and they slowly began to recast their overall defensive tactics to take account of the increasing sophistication and weight of British assaults.
Big Dipper.
Yeah.
It's not just one Big Dipper, it's two Big Dippers, and it's all relative. So we can be getting better, but now the Germans are doing something. So what are they going to do?
Well, instead of a static system of front lines, which would be defended to the death and endlessly contested through incessant counterattacks, they introduced the idea of an elastic defence system.
Elastic defence system.
The emphasis switched to strong points and concrete pillboxes across a deep battle zone with masses of barbed wire defences covered by the interlinked fields of fire of their machine gun fire.
So their barbed wire and the machine gun fire would sort of cover huge areas. There would be less people at right at the front. So would the frontline troops hold this to the death?
No, from now on they're permitted to retreat when a position becomes indefensible rather than be overrun
and die.
Meanwhile, the counter-attack divisions were lurking in the rear areas. I like the idea of this. They're lurking in the rear areas.
I'm not sure what you're thinking of here, Gary. Let's move swiftly on.
They're being held back only to strike if the British appear to be likely to break out of the frontline zone, when, of course, the British attacking troops would be at their weakest.
Well, because they battled all the way through all these pillboxes, barbed wire, machine guns and all the rest of it.
And they're now beyond the range of their artillery.
Their own field artillery. Yeah. So, of course, they're not having the concentrated barrages, standing barrages, creeping barrages, all those other things that have been developed during the Somme.
Comes a bit of a surprise.
Am I going to have a surprise?
After more than 2 years as the French commander-in-chief, Joffre seemed like a permanent fixture, but in December 1916 he was replaced by General Robert Nivelle.
Now there's two things wrong with him.
Or Robert.
No, I'm not going to say that he's part Scottish.
Now, war weariness had taken its toll on the French, and new solutions new saviours are required.
And that's what Nivelle's seen to be. He's done really well in the closing stages of the Battle of Verdun, and he did. It made him... how would I phrase this if I was being polite? It's not my normal nature.
A tad overconfident, I think, is how you would do it.
Yeah.
I would say that it was a bit more than that.
Yeah, he was mainly an artillery general. He thought he'd got a new scientific method of concentrated guns so that he could almost guarantee success. So a devastating opening barrage, then a creeping barrage would range right behind the German front lines, allowing the infantry to penetrate deep behind the whole defensive system, even overrunning their German artillery lines. Now, this is A, not particularly new, and B, not particularly easy to do at this stage without better tanks and the rest of it. What is he looking to achieve as opposed to bite and hold? This isn't bite and hold.
No, this is a return to the concept of a real breakthrough, of smashing the spectre of trench warfare once and for all.
Who'd like that?
Well, the French politicians, for one, they're deeply aware of the extent of war weariness amongst their people. And they were interested, well, frankly, more than interested, in what the charismatic General Nivelle could offer.
Yeah, the other thing, I mentioned he was part Scottish. I'm not even sure if that's true. I always just say that to annoy my Scottish friends. But the other thing he's good is he is charismatic. And he's got the fleur de bouche.
Oh, dear, there's a cream for that.
You might say that he was plausible. He could explain himself. He was wonderful.
So what's he do?
Well, he immediately discards all Joffre's plans. He plans a gigantic offensive by the French to seize the Chemin des Dames. That's above, behind, as you look at it, on the River Ain in mid-April 1917. Every available French gun will provide a devastating bombardment, and then two massed French armies would smash their way by brute force, with a third army ready to exploit the anticipated breach. He promised victory within 48 hours, which is how many days, Gary?
Two.
You're on the ball today.
Or a couple.
Although, yeah, so... Now, how do you think the British, how do you think Haig reacts to this?
Well, they were almost dumbfounded to find that the French were willing to take up the cudgels in this
quixotic
manner.
I wondered if you could say quixotic.
Now, previously, Joffre had applied near ceaseless pressure on Haig for the British to pick up their fair share of the fighting on the Western Front.
More fighting and also take over more of the line.
But now Nivelle was cheerfully volunteering to bear the main burden.
Is there a catch?
Well, he did require the British to take over a substantial extra sector of the French line from the Somme to the Oise in order to release the troops and guns needed to carry out his offensive.
Or does he just want anything else?
No, he also wanted Haig to launch a major diversionary offensive between the Scarpe and the Ancre rivers.
That's back to that almost that original plan, part of the original plan.
Yeah, but and that now would later become the Battle of Arras.
But now it's a diversion. Yeah. Is that right?
Yep. Yeah.
Now, who's...
Britain's still the junior partner.
Always is on the Western Front.
And even in the main Allied defences plan for 1917, they're the junior partner.
So Haig is wary, I think, of agreeing to the large increase in the British front, but he does. And the plans overall are finally accepted January 17. At a London conference where Nivelle presents his ideas to Haig, who is ambivalent but goes along with it, Chief Imperial General Staff, that's William Robertson, one of our favourites, and various members of the British government who would be politicians. Nivelle is attractive.
Well, he had an attractive personality.
Oh, yeah.
He was soldierly.
Eloquent.
And he had the natural confidence to sell his ideas to the British politicians, who, frankly, wanted to hear something like this.
And what did they normally have?
Well...
Gruff, miserable...
They normally had Haig, so there's a contrast there,
yeah,
isn't there?
Yeah, you can over-exaggerate how inarticulate Haig is, but he isn't... He's best on paper. He's not particularly... Who doesn't he like?
Well, he certainly doesn't like David Lloyd George... who'd replaced Herbert Asquith in December 1916 as British Prime Minister.
So there is one thing, and one thing you can go too far in attacking Lloyd George, because him and Haig had one thing in common. What was that, Gary?
Well, it was a belief that the total mobilisation of the country was necessary if they were ever going to win the war.
So what does Lloyd George think of Nivelle's plan?
Well, he very much approves of it. Here was a general that offered a guaranteed
politicians
method
like
of
guarantees.
Breaking the deadlock on the Western Front without the pain and sacrifice of manpower associated with the horrors of the Somme or some ghastly Flanders bloodbath.
Mm, that's what Haig's offering, of course. Lloyd George, well, he's not normally known for favouring an attack on the West Front. Where's he want? And both of them are clearly insane, but where does he...
Well, he clearly favours attacks through Salonika or Italy.
Well, what's he looking for?
Well, he's looking for...
I can see one from here.
He's not the only one, is he? But he's looking for the soft underbelly
to evade
fighting the Germans directly. And in a sense, Nivelle was offering another easy option for the British Empire.
And what do politicians like?
They like easy options.
They do.
And soft underbellies.
So true, the offence is going to be on the Western Front, but the French, they're going to pay the butcher's bill on most of it. And Haig... He doubts the feasibility of Nivelle's plans, but he's got no problem with the French flinging themselves forward, really. And after all, it does still mean that the main effort's going to be on the Western Front. And Haig, what is Haig above all?
He's a Westerner, as is Sir William Robertson.
Now, there is, by this time, and we've been through a lot of this, but this is revision to put you all in the same place when we start this series of talks properly, Air War Arras. There's a new element to, a new dimension in war. What is it? What is it that's new that might impact on air war?
Well,
it's aircraft.
Aircraft, by this time, they're taking their place at the very forefront of any tactical considerations. Photographic reconnaissance, it was at the centre of their role. Cameras clamped to the outside of the aircraft allowed the development of a photographic map of everything directly below that aircraft.
Yeah, and they also, if you canted at an angle, you could or use a different camera system, you could take oblique photographs, which are at an angle and allow you to, you could... It gives you a picture of what men can see. It shows you what's beyond the hill in a way that junior officers can understand. The hidden ground across which they'd be advancing, yeah. So are they taking, say, one or two a day of these?
No, by 1917, thousands of photographs.
Thousands?
Thousands of them.
Thousands?
Yeah. Now, once they're safely down on the ground, they had to be quickly developed and duplicated if they were to be of any real value.
Why quickly?
Well, because things change.
Do you mean the Germans?
The Germans.
Oh. Well, you're going to be Second Lieutenant George Banting of 34 Squadron RFC.
No, I think this is one of the most exciting quotes you've ever given me, Pat.
I must admit, my knees are trembling as I look at you.
With the crude equipment then in use, dry prints were produced 35 minutes after the aircraft had landed. The photographic hut was divided into four main compartments. The first of these was for developing plates, the second for exposing and developing of prints, the third for the drying of prints, and the fourth for plotting and the making of mosaics. Plates, after fixing and washing, were immersed in methylated spirit and, while still scarcely dry, were placed in enlargers and prints taken. The prints were treated in a like manner and passed in dishes of methylated spirits into the drying room. Here, they were separately held over a flame and burnt until dry. Two prints were taken from each negative, and as these reached the plotting room, they were marked with the date, height, and map references, and these figures were then copied onto the negative itself. The British intelligence officer was responsible for choosing the negatives from which prints for distribution to the various headquarters were to be made.
That was... absolutely fascinating. No, but it is. Do you know, but this is the nitty-gritty. This is what the personal experience accounts give you. You have to know. That's how they got them. They've got to be... There's no point taking photographs if you don't accurately print them and then disseminate them. So there you go. So what new art, we've discussed before, what new set of skill set, a new skill set arises? What would you say that was, Gary, as a result of all these photies?
Well, I'm assuming you mean the art of photographic interpretation, which was quickly born as a result.
So what could you see? Let's go through a list. Go on, spit them out at me. What's first?
Well, for starters, you could see German gun batteries.
Even if they're camouflaged?
Yeah, even if camouflaged. Machine gun posts, they stood revealed.
Dugout entrances?
Footpaths. Headquarters, yeah.
Any changes in any trench system?
Yeah, it was all immediately obvious to the experts.
To experts. So you and me looking at one of these maps probably wouldn't see much, but the experts could. Now, who takes these photographs?
Well, it's the ubiquitous B2Cs and variants, which were the mainstay of the Army Cooperation Squadrons of the RSC.
Let's go through their names. B2C, B2E, B2C... B2F, B2G, BE2H. A roll call of honour, Gary.
Absolutely, and they painstakingly photographed every square inch of the opposing German lines.
But that's not the end of the of what the aircraft can offer, is it? We've done all this. What else?
Well, artillery observation was just as important. Once the technological problems of getting a wireless transmitter and aerial aloft in an aircraft had been overcome, fertile minds...
Ooh.
You've got fertile minds.
Well, it seems to be a bit fertile today.
They soon solved the conundrum of one-way communication, and with the introduction...
Why don't they have two wirelesses, one incoming and one outcoming? Or why don't they have one that does both?
Because they didn't have the technology to do that.
And it would be too heavy to have both.
You wouldn't be able to fly.
Yeah, that's it. I'm not sure you could fly anyway for the same reason.
Now, they introduced the ubiquitous clock code, which I struggle to understand.
You do, Gary.
Whereby an aircraft could provide the corrections that would rain shells directly onto targets that were completely invisible from the guns or their forward observation posts on the ground.
Because the Germans are normally on the top of a ridge or, be more likely, in reverse slopes. Invisible, except from the air.
Now, continuing our trend of exciting quotes... The following quote is staggeringly dull.
Are you reading this one as well?
But it is crucial to understand why so many young men sacrificed their lives during the Battle of Arras. And you are going to be 2nd Lieutenant Francis Penny of 12 Squadron RFC.
The method of communication between the aircraft and battery was by means of a Stirling spark transmitter with a trailing aerial of about 150 feet used by the observer or the pilot to send messages in Morse code to the battery. A series of code letters were used denoting, this is by the battery, are you ready to fire? Fire! Always, of course, prefixed by the code number of the battery with whom we wish to communicate. Sorry, that's the aircraft sending that. The battery replied by placing wide strips of white cloth on a dark background in a single code letters acknowledging the message received from the aircraft. You see, I'm getting confused by it all already.
And that's got to be visible from the aircraft.
So are they big?
They're very big. They're about 6 yards long or something. Right.
These letters could be seen quite easily. As for this type of operation, we normally flew at an altitude of 2,000 to 5,000 feet. The actual position of the enemy battery was marked on a photograph, and from the centre, three concentric circles were drawn, denoting X equals 25 yards, that's one circle around the target, Y equals 50 yards, Z equals 100 yards, also giving north, south, east and west positions. All was now ready to commence the shoot. The observer then sent a message to the battery asking, are you ready? If in the affirmative, the observer sent by code the letter G for the first gun to be fired. The pilot, having manoeuvred the aircraft in such a position so that the observer could see both the flash of the gun as it fired and the burst of the shell. Watching closely, the observer would note the actual position where the shell had burst and advise the battery accordingly. For instance, if the shell burst at ZN, it indicated that the burst had taken place 100 yards north of the enemy battery position. Our battery would then adjust their sights accordingly, and the same procedure continued with each of the four howitzers until all guns were ranged correctly onto the enemy target, when the observer gave the signal GG when all guns fired as quickly as they could be loaded. Now that's interesting, because the ZN, I normally know that as the clock. This isn't the clock code. That's very interesting that you've given me that to read, knowing it to be the wrong thing, because the clock code, it wouldn't be ZN, it would be Z1, and that would mean 100 yards at 1 o'clock from the central position. And the clock code, so there, I don't understand. I understand why you don't understand it when it's like that. So if it burst at, for instance, what was the other one? 100 yards out, that would be Z. And say that was at 6 o'clock, that would be to the south.
To 6 o'clock.
Yeah. So that's what the system is. So that's quite interesting that you thrust that upon me.
Yeah, well, you know, as you're saying, you know, it's the clock code may seem relatively simple.
But it can be buggered by the selection of the wrong quote.
Absolutely. Now,
are the implications? What are the implications of clock code?
Well, unseen indirect targets could be carefully registered by batteries, which could then hold themselves in readiness to open up a devastating fire as and when required. However, hostile German batteries, once identified, could be systematically targeted and eliminated as threats.
Before you go over the top.
Before you go
Brilliant.
Over the top.
Now, does anybody notice this sort of work?
Well, the Germans...
Well, they're doing it themselves.
Yeah,
they?
The Germans...
Who would notice?
The Germans clearly recognise the importance of aerial army cooperation work, and they placed it at the heart of their considerations in deploying their aircraft.
And you're going to be General Otto von Below.
Below.
I know how to pronounce German words, Gary.
He's at the headquarters 6th German Army, and
what
he says...
What does he say?
The main object of fighting in the air is to enable our photo registration and photo reconnaissance to be carried out, and at the same time to prevent that of the enemy. All other tasks, such as bombing raids, machine gun attacks, and even distant reconnaissance in trench warfare, must be secondary to this main objective. So long as the execution of the main task is not ensured, all available forces must be employed for this purpose.
So, that's the priority. Now, in 1916, the German Air Force had been reorganised. So how was it reorganised?
Well, long-range reconnaissance for the headquarters staff was a responsibility.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Of the Flieger Abteilungen.
Now, they were better than things like the B-2C.
Oh, well, they're far...
Much better.
Far superior.
Why? How were they better?
Well, in performance, in both speed and altitude ceiling to anything the British Army had in at the time for cooperation.
So better than the Sop with 1.5 strutter, our other favourite as well, which was also used on that.
With 3 struts.
Now, so what else? Well, how else did they reorganise it? You can see I'm trying to avoid saying certain words.
Yeah, the local reconnaissance and direct artillery cooperation required by the infantry, that was supplied by the Flieger Abteilungen Alpha.
A.
Alpha.
Right. Oh,
they too were better equipped than their British counterparts.
Now, so that's the aerial reconnaissance, and then they had their Jasters of scouts, which are, of course, not reconnaissance aircraft, and we'll come back to that. Now, is there anything else that the Germans had to carry out these functions of aerial reconnaissance?
Yeah, I mean, as with the Allies, they supplemented their aircraft with kite balloons with observers directly connected by telephone ranging the artillery.
What's the advantage of that? Come on.
Well, they can stay up there all day.
Well, can't aircraft stay up all day?
Well, no. For obvious reasons.
Oh,
and
yeah.
They could severely restrict any movement by the opposing side within their range of vision, because they could immediately call up artillery intervention.
Yeah. Now,
which is why they were themselves quite a target.
They were a hell of a target, and we will be covering that during the course, because balloon attacks become very important in April 1917. No army can allow this sort of thing, this photographic and artillery observation, so they've got to try and stop it. And this is where the scout squadrons, the British scout squadrons and the German Jasters come in. They've got the first machine guns taken up. By 1915, the first scouts have arrived, the famous Fokker and other aircraft. There was a sort of escalating battle to gain domination. And it becomes very important because of the importance of what the scout planes could secure. But that's not that. That is basically to secure the photographic and artillery observation, is it? But who gets the glamour, do you think? The core aircraft doing the mundane work, or the scout pilots?
Well, unfortunately, it's the scout pilots, and
they're wreathed in glamour, aren't they?
Well, they are, and ever since, this allure has deflected attention from the real role.
Do you find them alluring?
I find them very alluring. Oh, look, there's an alluring scout, I say.
I think you really ought to think about what you just said. So you find a Boy Scout
alluring? No, the scout aircraft, Pete.
Right, okay. Right.
Now, for the British, in 1916, the RFC Army Cooperation Squadrons, they were charged with a series of onerous interlinked tasks.
Well, the thing. So the first one is they've got to do the photographic reconnaissance and artillery observation. They've got to fly contact patrols during attacks. Why is that? See where they've got up to.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Not greatly, but bombing raids to disrupt communications and arrest the Germans in their rest billets.
Right.
That's later.
That's right. But that's pretty well. And those three. And they've got to do, of course, all the artillery observation. Now, the main core aircraft that had to carry all this out, what was it? It was the BE-2C. And what were the other letters that were involved in this?
D, E, F, G, H. Yeah, and that's been described as a steady platform, hasn't it, the BE-2C?
Yeah, but I'm going to be Lieutenant Cecil Lewis. Famous.
Why?
Well, I just want to be. 9th Squadron RFC, who is very plummy voiced. The BE-2C was totally unsuited to the job, of course. It had the observer in front and the pilot behind. Whereas, with any sense, it should have been the pilot in front and the observer behind. But it wasn't. So the observer sat in a cockpit with four struts very close each side of him, wires to brace him well in and in front, and none behind, and a little seat he could just get into. And he really could do nothing at all except keep a lookout. When it got at all hot and you were liable to be attacked from the tail as much as anywhere else, he simply had to get up on his seat, kneel on the seat, which was a jolly cold, drafty business at 8,000 feet, even in the summer. And then he had to try and fire his Lewis gun back over the tail, just kneeling, not shooting the pilot, who was just behind him. It's ridiculous measure. We'll put a picture of the BE-2C. Now, why? Why are they still using the BE-2C and derivatives in early 1917?
Well, because when the BE-2s were ordered in their
thousands
early in the war, no one had conceived of the necessity of anything other than, as I mentioned, a stable observation platform. Now, they're facing far more agile German scouts and they're struggling for survival.
Now, we'd better have another little bit of a look at just again a bit of the history. It's back on the Somme. The Somme, which we may have mentioned in one or two podcasts. Have we mentioned the Somme, Battle of the Somme?
Once or twice.
Anyway, have we mentioned Brigadier General Hugh Trenchard?
Once or twice.
Now, he is he's commanding the RFC on the Western Front. He commanded 1st Wing RFC, then he ascended. Who did he work particularly well with?
Well, he works particularly well with Haig, doesn't he? And Haig recognises Trenchard's particular contributions.
He does, and for Trenchard, and we've just done this about 2 months ago. What underpins everything?
Well, underpinning everything was the principle that losses must be accepted to get the results required.
Now you're going to read a simple exposition of this, which means somebody else probably wrote it for him. No, not you. I mean, Trenchard was, like Haig, known to be somewhat inarticulate at the time. You're going to be Brigadier General Hugh Trenchard.
Heading to the unlimited space in the air, the difficulty one machine has in seeing another, the accidents of wind and cloud, it is impossible for aeroplanes, however skillful and vigilant their pilots, however powerful their engines, however mobile their machines, and however numerous their formations, to prevent hostile aircraft from crossing the line if they have the initiative and determination to do so. The aeroplane is not a defence against the aeroplane, but the opinion of those most competent to judge is that the aeroplane, as a weapon of attack, cannot be too highly estimated. On the British front, during the operations which began with the Battle of the Somme, we know that although the enemy has concentrated the greater part of his available forces in the air on this front, the work actually accomplished by their aeroplanes stands, compared with the work done by us, in the proportion of about 4 to 100.
4%, would you say that was?
Yes, that's one of my favourite statistics, that is.
You're a great admirer of Trenchard's use of statistics.
Yeah, he's obviously put a lot of thought into that one.
You don't think he's just plucked that out of the
air? I think that's a completely made-up number.
Is that what you used to do in management?
All the time.
Is that why the Crossrail project crashed to disaster?
I wasn't on Crossrail.
So what was it? He had a simple concept, didn't he? It's relentless offensive patrols carried out by his scouts, penetrating deep behind the German lines. They were intended to beat back German aircraft, keep them as far away as possible from the vital front line areas, and accepting any casualties. And also, if an occasional German scout broke through and attacked. Because who's going to be operating above the German and British front lines, above the trenches? It's going to be the artillery cooperation machines. And they, therefore, will be able to carry out their work relatively unmolested. Now, did this succeed on the Somme? This was the great test of Trenchard, a great test of the RFC. Had they succeeded?
Well, yeah, I mean, the RFC achieves an almost total domination of the skies above the lines and deep into the rear areas behind the German front.
Who is cross about that, would you say?
Well, I presume you mean the German infantry.
Did they complain?
They were constantly exposed from above while their own aircraft were conspicuous only by their absence, but they never mentioned it.
No. You're saying all soldiers never complain, gasp.
Well, the officers do.
Now, in September, something happens, and we've dealt with this, but it's all germane to the Battle of Arras. What arrives on the scene that makes a hell of a difference to the German response to British constant going across their lines?
Well, it's a new single-seater scout aircraft, the Albatross D1.
What's special about that?
Well, it marks the advent of the next generation of scout aircraft. It's powered by the 160 horsepower Mercedes engine up to speeds that approach 110 miles per hour.
Twin Spandau machine guns?
Yeah, they're capable of firing 1,600 rounds per minute.
Is that 800 each?
Yes, and they completely outclass anything that the British have available to
them. Well, most of them are only armed with the trusty Lewis gun.
Rounds?
It's written down. I'm not looking. I'm going 47.
Yeah, 47 rounds.
I think I've learned that now.
Now then,
and what happens after 47 rounds, Gary?
Well, the pilot's got to attend to the tricky task of changing the ammunition drum whilst in combat.
Now, the German Air Force, we mentioned this, that they were organised into hunting squadrons, and what were they called? Jagdstaffen. No, I can't. Why did I try that?
You got it pretty much right. Jagdstaffen.
Oh, wow. And what are they popularly known as? Jasters. That's it. And what's the most important and most influential in the early days in September 1916?
Well, that will be Jaster 2, which was commanded by the redoubtable Hauptmann Oswald Bolker.
We've heard of him.
We've recently done a podcast on Bolker.
Can you remember anything about him?
Well, I remember his friend crashed into him and he died.
That's a big part of the story. Well, I remember him as being a really bright bloke who had his dicta. You must remember his dicta. It was often talked about in the mess.
Yeah, his friend mentioned his dicta when he watched him die.
Yeah, and who was one of his most famous acolytes?
Oh, well, you'll be referring there to Leutnant Manfred von Richthofen. Although I think his brother was in the same squadron.
Later on, not then. No, that's Jaster 11 or whatever.
That's what I said, I think.
bastard. Desperately trying to trick each other here. So, that who notices this? Who's got his finger on the pulse? Who goes, hello, hello, hello?
Trenchard. He detects the early signs of a German aerial renaissance.
Now, you're going to read a letter he wrote back to the director of air organisation. We won't mention him again, but it's Lieutenant General, Lieutenant Colonel Sefton Branker. Don't get on the RO1! And he's back in London.
This is
you don't know what I mean by that.
This is Brigadier General Hugh Trenchard. We are fighting a very big battle, and fighting in the air is becoming intense. The fighting will increase, I regret to say, and not decrease. And it's only a question of our keeping it up longer than the Hun. If we cannot do that, then we are beaten. If we do it, then we win. I must warn you now that in the next 10 days, if we get fine weather, I anticipate a very heavy casualty list. There are many more German machines than there were, fast and much better pilots, which have appeared on our front.
You sound worried.
No, he's not wrong, though, is he?
He's completely right. He's absolutely right. Now, who could he get to support him?
Well, he successfully seeks the backing of Haig in campaigning for the earliest possible delivery of a new generation of British aircraft that he hopes would be able to contest the technical superiority established by the Germans. And you get the honour of being General Sir Douglas Haig.
The enemy has made extraordinary efforts to increase the number and develop the speed and power of his fighting machines. He has unfortunately succeeded in doing so, and it is necessary to realise clearly and at once that we shall undoubtedly lose our superiority in the air if I am not provided at an early date with improved means of retaining it. The result of the advent of the enemy's improved machines has been a marked increase in the casualties suffered by the Royal Flying Corps. And though I do not anticipate losing our present predominance in the air for the next 3 or 4 months, the situation after that threatens to be very serious unless adequate steps to deal with it are taken at once. Now, he's writing that. So he's basically saying we can get through the Somme. Let's hope there's no big battle planned for, say, April 1917, is what I'm thinking already. So, back home, well, this time you're going to be Lieutenant Colonel Sefton Branker. What do you think he's doing? He's trying his best, isn't he? But who else might be competing with him in a world at war?
Well, Lieutenant Colonel Sefton Branker says, unless British aviation can carry more weight in the eyes of the government than it does at present, we must be prepared to face a very ugly situation at the beginning of next spring. Now, as you've mentioned, you can't just bring through the next generation of aircraft.
And also, aircraft designing and building aircraft demands what? Resources.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, have we just ordered loads of tanks? Have we just ordered loads of mortars? Have we just ordered... Have we got to equip... There's a huge competition for resources, and the Royal Flying Corps is just one of several agencies, as I believe you would have called it at TFL.
Now, getting back to the front in that autumn, Oswald Bolker, he's proving to be a truly great mentor to his young pilots.
We did do all this, didn't we? Yeah.
And he's leading from the front. He in fact, achieved some 40 victories on his own account. Now, inspired by his example, many of them begin to score regular victories.
Well, they discover that they can realise that they have the superiority. Their aircraft, the Albatross D1, all these, they get another one there. Guess what they call that? Go on, Gary, guess what they call the next one in the series?
The Albatross D2s.
Yeah. And that's also beginning to deliver to be delivered. And he, and even when, and we, the podcast was quite sad about this, the one we did on Bolker, he's killed in this air action on the 28th of October 1916. But in one real sense, what would you say about this great man?
You could argue that his work was done by that stage. Jastor II had learnt well, and Richthofen, he'd already shot down 6 aircraft by this stage, and he would take up the mantle.
He'd become the new Bolker, if you like, yeah? I think you're right. Now, casualties the Albatross strikes, scouts lead from the front. They're they're taking a painful toll in the closing months of the Somme offensive. Other new single-seater scouts arrive. Can you pronounce these, Gary? What are they?
Well, the Halberstadt D2.
Yeah.
The Roland D2.
They do like a D.
The Roland D2. And you can do the last one,
Pete. The Faults D2.
The Do-Two.
The Doody-Doos.
Now, they're all perfectly good scout aircraft, but they're all overshadowed by the dramatic success of the Albatross.
Now, even though the casualties are rising, the RFC carries on delivering everything Haig requires right to the end of the Battle of the Somme. And what great lesson of aerial warfare has been learned?
Well, that supremacy in the air meant the ability to keep army photographic reconnaissance and artillery observation aircraft above the front, and the question of casualties incurred in doing so was almost immaterial.
That's a hard lesson.
But probably true, they had to keep doing it. And the losses on the ground would have been monumental had they not done so and provided that information.
Now, when the battle peters out for the British in November 1916 and for the French in December. We like to mention that after our podcast with Dave O'Malley, there's a general acceptance that the RFC, although there's been disappointment on the ground, there's been no disappointment in the air. The RFC had done its job, hadn't it? They'd done a fantastic time. They'd been tested in good times and bad. They never failed the artillery, and therefore they hadn't failed the infantry who depended for their lives on the success of them doing. How would you sum it up, what the RFC had done on the Somme?
Well, arguably, the Battle of the Somme marked the moment when the RFC finally came of age.
21.
Seeing as we're doing a lot of purple prose lately.
He's got the key to the door, never been 21 before.
Now, Trenchard, he never tries to evade his responsibilities, either to his superiors or to the men under his command. And although he had the moral courage to order his pilots up, whatever the odds, he also regularly toured the squadrons to ensure his men knew that he stood with them in the battle that raged.
But the thing about Trenchard, and we mentioned this in the podcast, he never goes what they call, in slightly unfortunate terms, going native, in the sense of he doesn't take on that. He doesn't start to become an RFC man. He knows the RFC is part of the army.
Oh, he absolutely knows that the parent body, the army, was...
They've not been weaned.
No, they've not been weaned from them. And he's right.
Now,
when the RFC was outclassed by the swinging pendulum of aircraft design, or roller coaster as you would describe it, he had the good sense not to blame Haig.
Trenchard knew not to blame Haig, definitely, yeah.
He knew that if faults existed, they lay with the fledgling aeronautics industry back in Britain. And in turn, Haig appreciated his efforts, and after the Somme, took the time to summarise the varied achievements and services offered by the RFC in his official dispatches. And you're once more going to be General Sir Douglas Haig.
The admirable. Haig could never pronounce that word.
No.
The admirable work of this corps has been a very satisfactory feature of the battle. Under the conditions of modern war, the duties of the air service are many and varied. They include the regulation and control of artillery fire by indicating targets and observing and reporting the results of rounds, the taking of photographs of enemy trenches, strong points, battery positions, and photographs of giving the effect of bombardments, and the observation of the movement of the enemy behind his lines. The greatest skill and daring has been shown in the performance of all these duties, as well as in bombing expeditions, always an afterthought. Our air service has also cooperated with our infantry in their assaults, signalling the position of our attacking troops and turning machine guns onto the enemy infantry and even onto his batteries in action. That also is not as big as it sounds at this stage, but it's the Haig is, as ever, seeing the potential for these things more than actually what they're delivering by that time. But there's a bit of a shadow. So the RFC's done so fab in the Somme, but there's these two things going on. One, they're beginning to be technologically outclassed, and two, what's the other? The big shadow lying across them.
Well, Haig had aggrieved at Nivelle and Lloyd George's behest that the Battle of Arras would start in early April 1917.
And what's the problem there?
Well, there's no way that a new generation of British aircraft would be delivered in sufficient numbers to counter the Albatross menace in the few months that was available.
So they're going to get buggered?
Technical term, yes.
So what does the RFC do? Can Trenchard go to Hague and say, can you just postpone the offensive?
No, somehow or other the RFC have got to continue.
Can Hague ask Nivelle to postpone?
No. The RFC have got to continue to carry out its manifold duties in ever more obsolescent aircraft, whatever the human cost. Yet,
blimey,
even with this prospect before them, with the German scouts increasingly running rampant, the morale of the RFC endured as they enjoyed simple Christmas festivities in the traditional style.
I don't know why I put this quote in, but I like it. This is you're going to be Second Lieutenant William Lidsey of 16 Squadron, Royal Flying Corps. Well, there's some great books on 16 Squadron.
Spent the day quietly until the evening.
Until
7 p.m. saw the commencement of some dinner, to which 11 of us sat down. Nothing was left of a 21-pound turkey, plum pudding flaming with brandy, for which occasion the lights were put out, a dozen of champagne and heaps of other little dainties. A highly successful dinner, for which we have to thank Madam, the landlady, who did the cooking. We then went round to the men's concert, found them making awful fools of themselves, disgustingly drunk. It was an excellent concert. An exceedingly drunk poilu, who came in from no one knows where,
A French chap caused
great amusement by trying to embrace and kiss all the officers, one of whom, more inebriated than the remainder of this flight, embraced the Frenchie on the stage. We retired at 11:30 p.m. to let the men go as they liked.
Now, I've remembered why I put this quote in, Gary, and it's because for a lot of these people, up and down the Western Front, the Royal Flying Corps would be celebrating Christmas. They don't know what's ahead of them. They don't know the Battle of Arras is coming up. They don't know that they're going to go they're going to have to start preparing for the battle. Not, remember, for the aircraft, it doesn't start on the 9th of April. It starts in January when they have to photograph every bloody inch of the whole battlefield from end to end, and also miles and miles deep. They've got to do all this, and they don't know that. And yet all these people are having a great time. But do you know what? It's going to be their last Christmas for an awful lot of them, isn't it? Because what's going to happen?
Well, by Easter, there's a new sacrifice required in the cause of their country at Arras.
That's almost a religious-like symbolism you've drawn out there, Gary. I congratulate you.
Thank you.
To do it. I wouldn't know.
Now, this new series of podcasts will follow this story. Now, if you want to know more, then read Peter Hart's Bloody April.
That's me, Gary.
Slaughter in the Skies of Over Arras.
Bloody April.
What did you want to call it, Pete?
I wanted to call it Up the Arras, because that's what happened to them. And on that note...
Cheers, Pete.
Up the Arras. Cheers. Thanks for listening to the show.
Blah, blah, blah.
If you'd like to support
blah,
us,
blah,
you can now buy us a coffee.
Blah, blah,
visit www.buymeacoffee.com/PGMH.
Or... visit www.blah, blah, 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 blah.
And we'd be jolly grateful.
Cheers.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH, or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?